Ekatra Foundation presents the Ekatra Dialogue, an exploration of the world's greatest thinkers and ideas. This audio summary has been prepared with the help of Ekatra AI. Okay, let's dive in. Imagine this. What if the toughest, maybe the poorest years of your life turned out to be the happiest, the most creatively alive?
It's a fascinating idea, isn't it?
Yeah, and that's really the heart of what we're exploring today with Ernest Hemingway's A Movable Feast. It's this posthumous memoir, basically a look back at his early days as a writer in Paris in the 1920s.
Right, published in 1964, a few years after his death, and it's become this iconic, almost mythic portrayal of that time.
So our mission today is to unpack this book. Using the summaries and analyses we've got, we want to understand Hemingway's journey, sure, but also, like, what can we actually learn from his experiences?
Yeah.
About art, about ambition.
And memory, too. That's a huge part of it. How we remember things, how we maybe shape those memories later on.
Good point. So Hemingway himself, Ernest Miller Hemingway, 1899 to 1961, American novelist, short story writer, journalist, huge figure.
Nobel Prize, Pulitzer Prize. I mean, his style, that spare, direct prose. It really changed the game for modern literature.
And he lived this incredibly adventurous life, didn't he? Often seemed larger than life itself.
He certainly cultivated that image. And A Movable Feast focuses on that crucial early period, 1921 to 1926. He's in Paris, an unknown correspondent, married to his first wife, Hadley Richardson, just finding his feet as a writer.
And that famous quote gives the book its title, right? If you are lucky enough to have lived in Paris as a young man, then wherever you go for the rest of your life, it stays with you. For Paris is a movable feast.
Exactly. It captures that sense of something formative, something you carry with you always, which makes you ask, why this period? Why does this book still hit so hard?
It's a good question. Maybe it's that paradox he describes. Sure. Being very poor and very happy.
I think that's definitely part of its enduring appeal. It taps into that romantic ideal of the starving artist, but Hemingway gives it his own unique spin.
Okay, let's get into his journey then, his formative years. He grew up in Oak Park, Illinois. What was that like?
Well, our sources point to this interesting tension in his upbringing. His father was a doctor, very outdoorsy, masculine influence.
Okay.
His mother was musically gifted, more artistic, maybe seen as more feminine in that context. And this dynamic, this sort of pull between those two worlds, seems to have really shaped him. You can almost see the seeds of the tensions in his later writing.
That makes sense. And he didn't go to college.
Right.
Straight into journalism.
Yeah, at the Kansas City Star in 1917. And that was huge for his style. Their style guide was apparently very strict.
Like what?
Things like, use short sentences, use short first paragraphs, use vigorous English. Basic stuff, maybe. But it became the absolute foundation for that famous Hemingway style. Clean, direct, forceful.
And then World War I happens. He's young.
Just 18, he volunteers as an ambulance driver in Italy, gets badly wounded by mortar fire.
Wow.
And that experience, facing death so young, that's where he gets this idea of grace under pressure. It becomes a code for him and for so many of his characters later on.
So you have this foundation, the family tension, the journalism discipline, the war experience, and then he lands in Paris.
Right. And this is where the struggle and the rise really happen. He's married to Hadley. They're living in a pretty basic cold water flat above a sawmill. Not exactly glamorous.
No. He talks about being hungry, doesn't he? Like, actually hungry.
He does. And fascinatingly, he almost weaponizes it. He writes about purposefully skipping meals, believing hunger sharpened his perceptions, made him see art more intensely. He even called it his philosophy of the empty stomach.
That's intense. A bit extreme, maybe.
Perhaps.
Yeah.
But it speaks to his incredible discipline. He had this rigorous routine. Get up early, go to a cafe, the Closerie de Lillo is a favorite, and just write.
Living simply, borrowing books.
Exactly. Borrowing books from Sylvia Beach's legendary Shakespeare and Company bookstore, soaking everything in, observing people. It was like this self-imposed, incredibly focused apprenticeship.
So that intense discipline, that focus, eventually leads to his breakthrough.
It does. He starts publishing short stories, developing that unique voice. The success doesn't come overnight, but it comes. And by the mid-1920s, with books like The Sun Also Rises, he's becoming a major literary figure.
And his peak achievements, well, they continue for decades, really. Mm. The Nobel Prize in Literature in 54 is probably the pinnacle.
For sure. And his legacy. It's complex. Obviously, people debate him constantly. But his impact on writing style, the way he captured a certain kind of masculinity, the themes of war, loss, nature, It's undeniable. A movable feast itself is part of that legacy, this carefully crafted look back at where it all began.
So let's dig into his core philosophy. What really drove him? What was underneath all that discipline and ambition?
At its heart, I think, was this belief that life is fundamentally tragic. There's loss, there's pain, it's unavoidable.
Okay, kind of bleak.
Well, yes, but the meaning comes through how you face it. Through authentic experience, through honest expression. For him, writing wasn't just a job, it was almost a sacred calling, a way to find truth or truth in the middle of the chaos.
And that connects to his writing theories, doesn't it? Like the iceberg theory.
Absolutely crucial.
Yeah.
The idea is that what you don't say is as important, maybe more important, than what you do. The story only shows the tip of the iceberg. The real weight, the dignity, lies beneath the surface in the omissions.
So it's about restraint, suggestion, rather than spelling everything out.
Precisely. And it wasn't just for fiction. You could argue he tried to live that way, too, that grace under pressure thing, showing strength by not showing everything, by keeping some things hidden.
And what about that famous advice he gave himself when he was stuck writing?
Yes. All you have to do is write one true sentence. Write the truest sentence that you know.
That feels important, like a mantra almost.
It really is. It's this practical tool for breaking through difficulty. Forget trying to be fancy or profound. Just find one thing, one simple thing that feels absolutely true, and start from there. It's about anchoring yourself in honesty, especially when things feel overwhelming.
Okay, let's talk about some key moments, those pivotal turning points that really shifted things for him. Our sources highlight a few. The first seems to be his relationship with mentors in Paris.
Definitely. Gertrude Stein and Ezra Pound were huge influences. Stein was this avant-garde force. She taught him about rhythm, repetition, modernist techniques, pushed him to strip things down.
She coined the term lost generation, too, didn't she, for his crowd?
She did. Their relationship got complicated later, apparently due to literary politics and personality clashes. But her early impact was undeniable. And she taught him a tough lesson about, you know, artistic independence eventually. Ezra Pound was more of a champion, a connector. He taught Hemingway about precision, economy famously telling him to distrust adjectives. And crucially, Pound helped him get published, connected him with editors. They were like his unofficial graduate advisors.
Okay, so that's a positive turning point, gaining those mentors.
Yeah.
But then there's a devastating one, the stolen manuscripts.
Oh, absolutely brutal. Imagine, it's December 1922. Hadley, his wife, packs almost everything he's written, originals, carbons, maybe even a novel he was working on, into a suitcase to bring to him while he's on assignment.
Yeah.
The suitcase gets stolen at the Gare de Lyon train station in Paris, just gone, years of work, vanished.
I can't even fathom that. How did he react?
It was crushing, obviously, but somehow he didn't completely fall apart. He had to start over. And some argue that this forced restart actually made him a better writer.
How so?
Well, he had to rely purely on his memory and his craft, maybe distilling things down even further. It taught him about impermanence, maybe clarified his vision in a really harsh way. A true trial by fire.
Wow. Okay, a third turning point.
Yeah.
This one feels more personal, maybe more symbolic of a shift in his life. The end of that first marriage.
Yes, the arrival of Pauline Pfeiffer. Hemingway calls her the pilot fish in the memoir, someone who signals the arrival of predators, essentially.
Not exactly flattering.
No. He begins an affair with Pauline while still married to Hadley. And this betrayal marks the end of that poor but very happy period. It's the point where, arguably, ambition and maybe a desire for a different kind of life start to overshadow that earlier, simpler happiness.
He expresses a lot of regret about it later.
Deep regret. He writes, "I wished I had died before I ever loved anyone but her, Hadley." It's portrayed as this great loss of innocence, the moment the feast truly ended. He essentially chose ambition and a new relationship over the partnership he had with Hadley. It's a really poignant and painful part of the story he tells.
It really shows how these moments, some inspiring, some just awful, carve out a life, doesn't it? It wasn't just raw talent.
Not at all. It was resilience, tough choices, dealing with catastrophe, navigating complex relationships.
Speaking of relationships, Hadley clearly looms large over the entire memoir.
She's absolutely the heart of it. Portrayed as this figure of lost innocence, his rock during those early struggles, his partner and everything. Her belief in him seems unwavering in his telling. The book reads almost like a long apology, or at least a tribute to her and what they lost.
And then there's F. Scott Fitzgerald. Their relationship seems much more complicated.
Very complex. Friendship, yes, but also pity, rivalry. Hemingway paints this incredibly vivid picture of Fitzgerald. He admires his talent, calls it natural as the pattern that was made by the dust on a butterfly's wings.
That's beautiful.
It is. But then he also portrays him as incredibly fragile, insecure, struggling with alcohol, kind of a hypochondriac on that trip they took to Lyon.
So it's admiration mixed with
what?
Judgment.
Maybe judgment, maybe a bit of professional jealousy, maybe just Hemingway's incredibly sharp, sometimes brutal observational skills. It certainly reveals a lot about Hemingway's own competitive streak.
And he does this with others too, right? Gertrude Stein, Ford, Madox Ford.
Mm-hmm.
Some portraits are pretty critical.
Definitely. And this brings up that big question about memory again. This was written decades later, near the end of Hemingway's life. He's looking back, yes, but he's also shaping the narrative.
Settling some old scores, perhaps?
It certainly feels like that sometimes. The book is colored by hindsight, by bitterness that developed over the years, probably by a fair amount of self-mythologizing, too. He's crafting his origin story.
So we have to read it, understanding it's his version of the past, not necessarily objective history.
Exactly. It's a powerful reminder that memory isn't just recall. It's an act of creation, of curation. We all do it to some extent, don't we? Shape our own stories.
Yeah, that's true. Makes you think about your own memories, how you frame them.
Mm-hmm.
So, pulling all this together, what are the big lessons we can take away from Hemingway's Feast, especially for us today?
Well, one powerful idea is the surprising value of constraint. His poverty wasn't just something to overcome, he used it. It sharpened his focus, his perception. It suggests that sometimes limitations can actually fuel creativity, force you to be more resourceful.
That's a really interesting way to look at challenges. What else?
The sheer importance of daily practice. Hemingway's discipline routine, that showing up day after day, it demystifies genius a bit, doesn't it? It highlights that consistent, focused work is just fundamental to getting good at anything.
The grind is real, basically.
The grind is real. And then there's his insistence on authentic experience and telling the truth, that one true sentence. It's a call to engage genuinely with life, to strive for honesty in how we express ourselves, whether it's in art or just, you know, living day to day.
Strip away the fluff, get to the core.
Exactly. But there's also a cautionary tale here, isn't there?
Yeah, the cost of success seems like a big one.
Definitely. The memoir shows how ambition and success can come at a real personal price. Losing relationships, perhaps sacrificing some essential part of yourself. It forces you to think about what you're willing to give up for your goals.
It's not a simple success story then.
Yeah.
It's much more layered.
Far from it. It really challenges us to think about our own movable feasts. Those formative times, those intense experiences that shape us, and the choices we made, the things we gained and lost along the way.
So, if we had to distill this down to three final takeaways, what would they be?
Okay, three takeaways. First, an emotional insight. I think it's the profound poignancy of regret, especially concerning lost love and betrayed trust, as shown with Hadley. It reminds us how deeply our past choices, particularly in relationships, continue to echo.
That resonates. What about an intellectual one?
An intellectual insight. It has to be the power of the iceberg theory, the idea that true depth often lies in what's unsaid or omitted. It challenges us to look beyond the surface in art and in life and appreciate the weight of restraint and implication.
Okay, good one. And finally, a universal lesson.
A universal insight. I'd say it's the validation of disciplined practice combined with authentic engagement. Hemingway shows that mastery isn't just about talent. It's about showing up consistently, facing reality squarely, and striving to capture truth, even if it's just one true sentence at a time. That commitment applies to any craft, any life pursuit.
Powerful stuff. So, a movable feast isn't just a nostalgic look back at Paris. It's complicated.
It really is. It's a self-portrait of an artist forming, a love letter to a time and a person he lost, a testament to discipline, but also a map of his regrets.
It leaves us thinking, doesn't it, about our own hungry years, those times we were searching, striving, maybe struggling, but also incredibly alive.
Absolutely. How do those times still feed us? Or maybe, in some ways, how do they still haunt us? It's a question worth pondering.
Join us next time for a new episode featuring another world-renowned individual, a new book, and a new idea that has shaped our world. This audio summary is brought to you by Accatra Foundation.